Welcome to the Next in Time podcast, where we explore the fascinating depths of how people have the potential of impacting the world with the mission and vision of their project. Join us on this audio journey as we uncover the hidden gems of one's vision, delve into thought-provoking discussions of why they're pursuing it, and see how they're going to make an impact. If you're a curious person, this podcast is your go-to destination.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Next in Time podcast. I'm your host, ST, and today our guest is Richard Rosser. He is a filmmaker and author who has been part of many hit TV shows, including Grey's Anatomy, Chicago Med, This Is Us, MacGyver, and especially my favorite show, 24. He's also the author of the book ChatGPT Simplified, and through his book, he's looking to provide ways on how to utilize AI to help write better stories. So, Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, ST. I am excited to be here.
Yeah. You know, this is like the perfect time to even have a discussion considering the fact that just yesterday, the writer's strike, it's today, the writer's strike, but now the actor's strike has begun.
Right. SAG has joined the membership of SAG. Actually, I'm a member of SAG. And so we voted to go ahead and strike. So it's not just in solidarity with the writers anymore. It's all actors striking as well as the writers. So it's, today is, in fact, I'm looking to figure out where I might be able to go over this afternoon and walk the picket line.
Oh, if you can brave the heat wave down in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's true. It might be very hot out there, but you know what? It's a topic worth discussing, and it's a situation worth action.
Yeah, this is an interesting phenomenon happening right now, considering the fact that AI is being a tool where, you know, people are being afraid of, people are really like fearing the fact that that could be able to say, that could write better scripts than your typical screenwriter, or even, let's say, you know, I think the reason why actors are striking is because they fear that AI can just take over their own imagery, and they take copies of their own image and never get compensated for it. So you could have that.
Right.
So.
I mean, there are many layers to the actors. You know, there's voice duplication. If you just think about like a podcast, right? I mean, you know, in fact, ST, how do I even know that you're a real person? How do I know that you aren't just some chatbot that's chatting me up here in this podcast?
Well, I just don't think an AI version of me would sound so, let's just say, disillusioned sometimes. Like, sometimes the way I speak, it's very, I think more than I think first before I even open up my mouth. So, and AI kind of does, it really does, it does not capture my flaws better than I can.
Nice. I love it. You know, we're going to dive into some of that today as we talk, because it's interesting, in that little statement, you encapsulated my approach to using AI and ChatGPT in specific as a tool. And ST, what I mean by that is, what did you say? You said that AI couldn't have the flaws or the quirks that essentially that you have, right?
Yeah.
And it would be duplicating those.
Yeah, I can make a lot of mistakes when I try to articulate myself, but AI cannot.
Right. And that's my approach is, you know, I think there's a fear among folks that if we all start using this technology, that all of our communication is going to turn to mush.
Yeah.
And think of it like this. If you had a great prompt and you said, oh, Richard, hey, check out this prompt. You can use this prompt to write a blog post. And you send it to me and I write a blog post using it. And then I send it off to two or three friends and they send them off to two or three friends. All of a sudden, we've got this prompt that is going viral and everyone's using this same prompt. And so we might look at all these blog posts and go, ugh, boy, they have that the same flavor and sound and feel to them. And whereas if you say, hey, I've got this prompt, and then I take it and I infuse that prompt with bits and pieces of my personality, and I say, I want the prompt to, you know, infuse some energy and some humor and maybe some pop culture references, all of a sudden I'm making that prompt me. I'm giving it a bit of my personality in terms of what it'll generate. And ultimately, I think that's the most important thing to remember as we're using this tool, is that we as creators are in charge of the tool, right? We're using it to as an extension of ourselves. And so I don't want something that's just gonna spit some piece of crap out, right? I want something that will help me tailor a message that can help amplify my creativity and boost my individualism.
Right. And so this is one thing a lot of actors, even screen and writers, what they really like to profess is the fact that they want to really extend a part of their personality into what they do. And if AI were to take over and just say replace all of that and just be able to say, okay, we can just write better stories than a typical person, which this is the cause for a lot of this whole strike happening in
Well, there's, from the writer's standpoint, there from my understanding, there are two main issues. One is AI, but then the other is the fact that for years, I mean, it's almost as long as TV has been in existence, the business model has been, okay, when a writer writes a project, they get a residual, they get a certain portion of that project each time it's aired. And that goes down a little bit over time. But, you know, when you talk about a sitcom, and the sitcom gets syndicated. Well, once a sitcom is syndicated, they have, 100 episodes. And so they can sell that to the local and regional markets, and the writers get money from that. And so do the actors. They get residuals. And the streaming services have somehow, because it's a new way of presenting shows, they've gotten around the residual payments. And so, again, from my understanding, writers and actors, they don't get as much or if any residuals in some cases once the initial air of their project or show, they don't get the residuals like they used to. And the residuals really, I mean, you know, the general public thinks of residuals as, oh my gosh, that's gravy. That's the frosting on the cake. But for a lot of actors, a lot of writers who are working in Hollywood or New York or, you know, whatever production center, that it helps sustain them through the times when they're not getting roles, or they're not working on projects. So it's an important part of their ability to make a living. It's a big problem because the streaming services, the big three, you know, Netflix, Amazon, and Apple are making a lot of money. And so they're not passing the portion of who created those projects onto the folks who helped create the projects.
I mean, because the way Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu, they kind of run it as it's more of a tech company, not not a film studio.
Exactly. I mean, that's so how they all start out, right?
Yeah, their dynamics are not the same in a way. Like the way they're supposed, like they're trying to enact what you call the world of big tech.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to enact the world of the big tech into the world of filmmaking, which is not the same world as big tech. So right. It's kind of like, exactly. I think this is, so in a way that's just that those worlds are colliding, and that's the catalyst for the strike.
I agree. Yeah. And that has brought up the AI issue, because it's, you know, with ChatGPT coming out last November, it's really brought AI and generative AI specifically to the forefront, and everyone has a sense of it now because it's been in the news so much, it's been in media so much.
Right. And so let's get to know more about you, Richard. I believe you were part of a slew of TV shows that everyone talks about, especially like Grey's Anatomy, Chicago Med, This Is Us, and also my favorite show, 24. And so, you know, I'm actually glad I was able to get a writer who actually wrote one of my favorite shows on this podcast. Oh. So I just wanted to know, tell me more about those experiences, you know, being a screenwriter yourself. Like, what were those moments like for you?
Well, those shows are, I'm incredibly lucky to have had a chance to work on those shows. In addition to those shows, I've worked on many, many pilots and shows and movies. that that never saw the light of day, and or they, you know, they aired once and then never aired again. And those shows, you know, I'm a storyteller from birth, I guess you might say. My father was an amazing storyteller. He loved to tell story jokes, and that was sort of his forte. And so I learned from him in terms of how to bring stories to life with physicality, with voice modulation, with pitch, with hand gestures. And so when I went to college, I took one film course. That was all they had. You know, every school that in the nation now has a film program and digital cinema programs. And back then, this college I went to was a small liberal arts college. It had one film program. And I took this film program and I made this 3-minute black and white animated little movie. And it ultimately ended up winning a Student Academy Award and it blew my mind.
Wait, and that's a legit, like from the Academy, right? Or
yes, from the Academy.
Wait, I never knew that.
And so I said, you know, I said to my professor in this course, because we were doing live action, little live action shorts. And I said, you know, I'd really love to do an animated film. And he said, animated film? What are you talking about? I can't help you with that. If you want to, you can make one, but I have no idea, you know, how to help you. And I found this old Bolex, a 16 millimeter Bolex camera on a shelf in the storeroom. And I cleaned it up, cleaned it off and made this little movie. And so yeah, I ended up, they flew me to LA. I actually roomed with Spike Lee. Yeah. He had won a Student Academy Award for his thesis film from NYU Film. And so it propelled me forward. But ST, it's similar to what folks have available to them today, right? I mean, back then, I was cutting everything on film. I mean, I was using an old film splicer and glue, and I mean, or tape, and it was back in the film ages. And now, I mean, think about it. You could take your phone, you could film or tape something, and then record something, and then you can edit it and have it on the air on TikTok or YouTube or Facebook or, you know, whatever, Snapchat or Instagram shorts or stories, and you can have it out there within minutes or hours of when you created this thing. And hundreds, if not thousands, if not potentially tens of thousands of people can view your work. So it's a really interesting time. And again, you know, you touched upon it before with this question about technology overlapping with visual content or visual media. And it that's another area or instance where technology companies have become the purveyors of this visual content, which is really, really interesting.
And so now, in a way, regarding when you worked on these different episodes, right, were you always very keen on making sure you create the best quality episode out there for each of these shows, or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for instance, with 24, you know, the first season we started off, it was a show that took place in 24 hours, and each episode was an hour in the day.
Yeah.
And the intensity of it, the showrunner, Joel Surnow, I remember he at one point we were on set, and one of the directors said, you know, hey, it's been like 6 hours or 7 hours, and we should have someone come through with a plate of sandwiches so that everyone, you know, can have folks grabbing sandwiches and eating. And Joel came on set and he said, nope, there's three things that we're never going to show any of our characters doing. It's eating, sleeping, or going to the bathroom. And we were all like, yeah, but I mean, the whole show, the whole premise of the show of someone being up for 24 hours dealing with these issues and challenges and chasing the bad guys, I mean, certainly someone's going to fall asleep at some point. And yes, definitely someone's going to need to go to the bathroom. And it's pretty much granted that someone's going to get hungry. And he said, yeah, but you know what? People aren't sitting down to watch someone go to the bathroom or eat or sleep. When they sit down to watch our show, they want to be on the edge of their seat. They want a nail biter. They want something that transcends those petty things of eating, sleeping, and going to the bathroom. And so it was really interesting to hear his take on it. It wasn't that he disagreed that people need to go to the bathroom or need to sleep or need to, you know, need to eat something. But his whole take was, people are going to find that uninteresting.
Yeah.
And so we need to go the opposite and go to the opposite extreme of making this. I mean, at points, I felt like the editors were cutting this show with crack cocaine, right? It was so, or heroin. The 24 was so addictive. You know, it's interesting.
In a way, 24, when I watched each of these episodes, I just always felt like, okay, so when they're making each and every episode, they had to make it within like a 24-hour period or something. It's just because the way it's spliced up, the way it's intense, it like every movement of every character, it feels very exhilarating just to watch them do all that. And I thought, like, whoever made the show, they have to be so high on that.
Oh, absolutely. For listeners who don't know what we're talking about, this show was about Jack Bauer, played by Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah.
He was an anti-terrorist agent with a fictitious unit, sort of like the CIA or FBI, called the CTU, the counter-terrorist unit. And so in each episode, he was working on trying to catch the bad guy, the terrorist bad guys, who were very often trying to either, assassinate a presidential candidate or blow up a city with a nuclear bomb. Or kidnap a leader. It was just edge of your seat, just full volume, 90 miles an hour for an hour TV. And one of the coolest parts was, remember how, as we come to a commercial, you've got Jack Bauer, you've got the folks in the CTU, you've got the bad guy, you've got Jack's wife who's been kidnapped. And at the, right before the commercial, each time there would be this clock ticking or countdown. It would go ding, dink, dink,
yeah,
dink, and then you would go out to a commercial, and it would sort of show a freeze frame of where each character was in their sequence or their scenario, and so it would literally like freeze the action as you went to a commercial, and then when you came back from the commercial, it would back out of that and then go back into what was going on with the various characters. It was really seminal for its time. It was really incredible. Show, yeah.
I mean, that's kind of how Kiefer Sutherland became a major like TV player in like especially shows like Designated Survivor.
Yep, absolutely. And Touch, and I'm trying to think, there was another one he was in, but it was interesting because when I got, so I had worked with the production manager and the producer of 24 on another show, and they called me up and said, hey, we're doing the show and why don't you come in, we'd love to talk to you about it. So I went in and met with them. And they were telling me about it. And I said, well, then who's going to be in the show? And they said, Kiefer Sutherland. I said, wait a second. Kiefer Sutherland, I thought he'd quit the business. Because at that point in time, Kiefer Sutherland had been a major movie star. He had been in all sorts of movies, Flatliners and Stand By Me. And there were all sorts of movies that he'd been in. And he had quit the business and he was out on the rodeo circuit. I don't know if you know this, but he was... I don't know what all he was doing, but he was roping and barrel racing, whatever events he did, but he was doing them on the rodeo circuit, and he had left the business, and they sucked him back in, pulled him in to do the show. And then, as they say, the rest is history. He's gone on to Designated Survivor, and he's got another show. I'm trying to remember the new show. I saw something for it, a billboard on a bus flying by, but yeah, I mean, that solidified him as a major, major star.
Yeah. And now going forward to to this book that you've written, which is ChatGPT Simplified. And, the way you're trying to profess a new vision of how writers can use AI to be able to write better stories. So what was the reason why you decided to write this book for?
Well, I do a lot of workshops and seminars. I do consulting with startups, entrepreneurs, ongoing businesses. And I also do a lot of work with colleges, community colleges, and graduate students, researching and analyzing how story works and how we can collectively as human beings use story to become better communicators. And so over the course of the past couple of years, I've created my workshops, and in each workshop has a theme. And I'll have breakout sessions where we have the participants create stories and figure out how to create compelling, captivating stories. And so back in January, I was working with a tech school in Oklahoma, And they said, hey, we love your approach to storytelling. We'd love to get you to write a storytelling for trainers course. And I said, fantastic. And they said, because, you know, we have all these trainers come through and some of them really don't know how to tell a story and they could use story to emphasize the points of their training programs. I said, great. So we hung up the call and I said, okay, now I'm stuck because I don't know anything about trainers and training programs. And I was bemoaning that to a friend and she said, you should check out ChatGPT. I said, what's ChatGPT? And she said, it's like a search engine on steroids. And I said, okay, great, because I need help because I'm trying to do this, you know, I'm trying to do this workshop based on storytelling for trainers. And so I dove into ChatGPT and realized it's this amazing resource for brainstorming, for organizing and outlining, for research, although there are severe limitations in terms of research, right? You want to make sure that what it's generating is actually real. And then also for content creation. And so I realized that this tool, ChatGPT and AI in general, is really, it's a tool akin to say a calculator for a mathematician or an engineer, right? I mean, you can't expect a mathematician or engineer to come up with the math or science or engineering behind a rocket to put a SpaceX rocket up in space with just a pad of paper and a pencil,
right?
So creatively, and we're not just talking about authors. When I'm running a seminar or a workshop, I'm talking about how to harness the power of story and what I call AI enhanced storytelling for all sorts of folks, marketing folks, sales folks, people in R&D, people in manufacturing, folks who are doing research and developing programs and apps. Because ST, I heard a statistic a couple of weeks ago that said that 85% of all our daily communication is told through story. And I thought, whoa, 85%. And then I started to think about it and I realized it may even be higher than that. Because story is the way that we communicate as humans. For 10,000, 14,000 years, we've been telling stories to each other about how to get away from danger, what fun we had over the weekend. And so I've put together this book, ChatGPT Simplified, to help all sorts of folks, and specifically folks who are really not that technically minded. I'm not a programmer, I'm not a coder. My approach to ChatGPT is through the lens of a storyteller. So what I did was I thought, okay, I want to write a book that's really for everyone. It's for the layperson out there who doesn't understand the difference between a neural network and a natural language processor. And so, and there are a lot of people who are confused by all the terminology and the jargon. And so what I did was I wrote this book. It's got a ton of pop culture references. It has a lot of humor mixed in. It's a very quick read, but it's also, it's a creative catalyst to help folks figure out how to harness this new technology and use it to amplify their creativity and show their individualism.
Right. And so why is it that ChatGPT, why is there this perception that people, that ChatGPT will provide better writing than humans can?
Well, I think that there's a fear. There's a fear from folks that it will do that. Now, with my experience or in my experience dealing with ChatGPT for, going on almost 7 months now, I've realized that, in fact, ChatGPT can write, but it takes a lot to get it to the point where it can spit out something that's 90 or 95% of what you're looking for. And that's all based on crafting effective prompts. But ultimately, we as human beings we're the critical thinkers, right? We're the ones who are the arbiters of what works and what doesn't, what, the good, the bad, and sometimes ugly, that ChatGPT, the answers that it's spitting out. And so it's really important for people to remember that ChatGPT and AI, really, they are just tools. And we can use them to help expand our creativity and help write content. But ultimately, we're the ones who have to decide if the content works within the context of what we're looking to say and the message that we're trying to get across to our audience.
And in a way, is ChatGPT a... I think in a way, what you're mentioning is that ChatGPT is like the, like what you call the executor of something, while the people running like people behind some sort of a creative project. They're just more like the brains.
ST, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's a fantastic sort of overview statement. And it's really what I try to point out to everyone that I'm working with is that, again, it's just a tool. I mean, think back and look, everyone's anxious. Some people are anxious, excited, and some people are anxious with doom and gloom because they think that ChatGPT is going to replace them in their job. They think that it may end up becoming Skynet, like the Terminator, and take over the world, right? But if you think about all the technology that has come, all the big technological revolutions or inventions, right? I mean, one of the first was the printing press. Before the printing press, all the stories were told through the oral tradition. So think a second about all the minstrels and the bards and the jesters, all those folks who told stories or conveyed stories through the oral tradition. And when the printing press came out in, I think it was around 1450, they freaked out, right? And they thought, oh my gosh, there's this new thing called a book and people won't need me to tell them the story anymore. They're going to be able to just read it. So everything's going to go away. But contrary to that, think about how many types of storytellers there are today. There are comedians, there are musicians, singers, songwriters, there are movie makers, there are TikTok artists, and, you know, folks on TikTok. I mean, there are so many ways for folks to present their information visually, verbally, orally. And so what the panic was about was, oh my gosh, we're going to be replaced. But in fact, what it did was it expanded the possibility of communication. And so if we smash cut, you know, what, 600 years later, we're talking about ChatGPT and AI, and there are a lot of people who fear that it's going to replace them in their job. And certainly, I'm not going to say it's not going to replace any jobs. It may replace some folks, but it's also going to open up opportunities that we never knew or that didn't exist prior to this technology. For instance, you know, the job of a prompt engineer. It's a job now. People who come up with, it's almost like coding, but it's writing with words, enabling ChatGPT to return a response that can ultimately give you content or research or whatever it is that you're asking ChatGPT to do.
And one big fear, as I've mentioned before, that there's a lot of people afraid that, okay, the AI systems can start thinking much as equivalent to humans and even much more intelligently than humans. And, you know, it's not just about their jobs, but let's just say their dignity. Like, okay, there's that fear that AI can write a better script than they can, and like be able to write something that is very like that can hit every nuance of human emotions that only that humans cannot even do themselves as good as that the AI as the AI systems can. What do you say about that kind of fear?
Well, I think when the media gets a hold of things, they sensationalize them. I mean, that's sort of their job. You know, if you talk about the news, well, the news is supposed to present situations and ideas and concepts with a nonpartisan, non-biased presentation. But the media itself, and now we're including social media and talk shows, and, you know, the more people watch, the more money they make from advertising or from sponsorships. And so, you know, I know that it's been shown over the past 10, 20 years that social media tends to sensationalize the negative. And people stay online longer when they're presented with negative versions of concepts and situations than they do when they're presented with positive. If something's hunky-dory, if it's great, you're like, okay, great, I'm going to move on. But if something's negative, you want to get in there, you want to dive in and grind it up and spit it out and get pissed off and mad at someone. And so I think that there's a certain amount of sensationalism with regard to AI in general and ChatGPT in specific. Without getting into too many technical terms, I mean, there is specific AI, which is AI that's programmed to do one or two things very, very well. And then there's a general AI, which is sort of the AI sentient being. And we're potentially decades away from that, if maybe ever achieving that. And so I think that the media has worked to sensationalize the idea that it's going to take over our lives. It's going to completely destroy people's careers because it's going to take away every job that exists on the face of the earth. So I think it's been blown out of proportion because, you know, folks have an ulterior motive of making more money. The more people watch their program, so the more people pay attention. And that's not to say that that ChatGPT doesn't have limitations, that it doesn't have negative facets to it. But if you think about any major invention, social media, we're now finding out that the attorney general says that social media is really bad for our kids. You know, there are great positive points about social media in terms of the internet. I mean, think about the internet. There's so many, I don't think people nowadays could live without the internet. But yet there are all sorts of conspiracy theories and folks on the internet singing all sorts of crazy, crazy stuff. And so in order to get the positive aspects of a technology, you know, I mean, nuclear energy, it also created the hydrogen bomb. So Everything has its positives and everything has its negatives. And my approach is, okay, this technology is here to stay. I mean, most people are unaware that AI has been around since the 50s and some versions of it since the late 40s in some way, shape, or form. And it's only since ChatGPT exploded onto the scene that everyone realizes, oh my gosh, this is here, it's now. Well, it's been here and now. Think about Netflix or Amazon. When you go onto Netflix, it suggests a program based on what you liked before. That's AI. When you go onto Amazon, it suggests products. If you go onto GPS on Google Maps to put in an address, it's working with AI, the voice commands, Siri, Alexa. It's all based on AI. So we've all, Grammarly is based on AI. We've all collectively been using AI without really being aware of it from a consumer standpoint for years. And it's only now that ChatGPT has exploded on the scene and is available to the masses so that we can actually, each of us, call up ChatGPT and use it in and of itself, as opposed to it being integrated as part of a program or a system, that all of a sudden we're realizing, oh my gosh, this is here. It's for the masses. And so it can be used as a tool.
Sorry, Richard. Yeah, I just wanted to say we're running out of time, but...
Oh, yes, we are.
Yeah, we're running low on time, but I just want to thank you for coming on and being able to talk about this whole vision of how AI can be... Either can be a benefit for writers. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah, we'd love to have you on another episode and we can delve deeper into that kind of
sounds good ideas. To me.
So maybe that'd be a better way of, you know, going forward. So thank sounds you so good. Much for coming. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's been my pleasure, ST. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Next in Time podcast. We hope you enjoyed diving into the intriguing vision of our guest today. Don't forget to subscribe and follow us on social media to stay updated on future episodes. If you have any suggestions or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay curious and keep exploring.